so I've dealt with these issues in considerable detail over the course of my career. My principal responsibilities here are to discuss the panel's previous decision and how nothing has changed. However, I also want to respond to many of the issues that each of you raised in the context of doing that. My principal theme is clear. You got it right the first time. And you did very clearly so. I know many of you didn't participate. Some of you participated in the original panel, but the panel exactly understood the nature of ad valorem tax litigation. Facts are very local. Facts are very specific. There's no question as to real estate. They've conceded that. The other ground that they've pled in every single case is unequal appraisal. An unequal appraisal under Texas law may only be measured within the context of the same appraisal authority. That is individualized. So as to that issue, even with respect to their personal property, there is nothing common. Now, as to the claim that, and one of the questions I was going to ask was, gosh, what's the fact? Where is this common fact that we've heard of? Because there was nothing in any of the pleadings filed with this panel that identified a common fact. But we did get, finally, a claim that convenience stores basically, well, let's start off. Convenience stores and refineries both have underground storage. So the facts relating to underground storage would be common facts, and that is utter nonsense. The type of storage facilities at those two types of entities are completely and totally different and have numerous factual differences as to the way they are handled. First of all, very little refinery storage is underground. It is mostly in those large, round storage facilities that you can see. They're of entirely different manufacturer. They have entirely different environmental concerns, which also affect their value upon resale.
What do you say to Mr. Tipp's argument that, look, that's going to be the case in every one of these MBLs? Take asbestos, the classic one. You've got different kinds of products that people have put out in the market. You have different levels of exposure. You have different types of defendants, including premises owners versus product manufacturers. And so you have people that manufacture dust masks in with people that manufactured asbestos-containing products, in with people that didn't do either of those things but actually just purchase some of those things. So, but, you know, if you were to say that the common fact is taxation, wouldn't you agree that all of these cases are ad valorem tax cases?
I would agree with that, but that is...
Is that common enough to meet the standard under the MDL statute?
Absolutely not, Justice Blaine. Okay. It is not at all. What they're confusing, what they're trying to do here, is they're talking about the ultimate issues. The ultimate issue is defined by statute here. It is market value in most cases, and unequal value in others. And unequal valuation is very precisely defined by the Texas legislature. It has to be proved in one of three very specific ways. So all of those, that's common to every ad valorem tax case. And folks, if y'all certify this, every ad valorem tax case that wants it is going to be contending that they belong in this type of case, pretrial case management. Because the types of things they have identified are true of every ad valorem tax case. Now, the facts are not the same, and this is the problem. What they say is because you are doing similar properties in some of these cases, and I want to deal with that issue very precisely. First of all, as to refineries, there are, any expert in refineries will tell you there are no two refineries alike. Not even the least. They have different supplies. They use different types of crude to produce different types. Most all of them produce gasoline, but not all. Some produce industrial coke. Many of them produce jet fuel. Others produce very specific things, and they are configured much differently. Yes, they all have a cat cracker. Yes, they all have certain towers, but they're not common, they're not the same age, and they're not of the same manufacturer.
And what about the issues that he said would be, I guess I'm not sure he's saying they're common, but they're common in the sense that this is what the pretrial judge would decide, the qualifications of the experts, number one. The discovery that is common to all the districts, motions in limine, scheduling depositions generally, those are the things I wrote down. And what about those?
Well,
as being sufficient for a transfer to a pretrial judge, not only the fact that they're common issues to be determined, but it also goes to convenience. That's his argument.
Well, let me take the commonality issue first. First of all, those are not common facts. Those are procedures, in fact, that occur in every civil lawsuit, any of them. So there's nothing that's common about that with respect to Valero's litigation here or any property tax litigation. Those are procedures we all go through. The context of the decisions to be made are entirely different in many of these cases. We raise different issues in the trial of the convenience stores, for example. The case that we went forward with, we didn't get far enough before the client settled 17 cases instead of bearing the cost of trying all of those. They settled it in mid-trial. So we didn't even get to our presentation, which was convenience stores, personal property, typically sells in place. So location is a major factor. The bulk of the sales of such property, now their contentions are fairly uniform. They get one expert on the cheap. He comes in, says everything's the same. That doesn't make it true. And that is not what we were contending in.
Of course, that's their contention. And all they want to do is get a determination one time that from standpoint of the court's ruling, these qualifications are going to pass muster. The various districts' experts don't necessarily have to agree with that person. Right. That's what creates the trial.
Correct. But what you're talking about, again, is not the type of commonality that the rule says that this panel's decision must be based upon. Now, yes,
The rule doesn't really give a lot of guidance about commonality. And so if we look at the examples that Mr. Tipps was using, then it does appear that there's a pretty low threshold for establishing commonality, nothing like what would be required for a class action, for example.
But, Justice Bland, the decisions of this panel in particular, and I realize they're moving to the federal panel because, frankly, none of this panel's prior decisions support their contention in this case. But look at the commonality of facts we've looked at. Hurricane Rita bus fire. The name says it all. There was a bus fire. Everything about each case arises from that. That's a common fact within the meaning of the rules.
But what about asbestos and silica? How do we distinguish those cases from this one?
The key issues that were so common in those cases was, does asbestos or silica cause the range of health problems that are present for a variety of individuals? True, due to a variety of exposures. But the fundamental fact question is that causation. Does silica, does asbestos cause that? We don't have anything like that in property tax litigation. When we're dealing with these things, we're dealing with the facts involved in determining these issues are very much akin to the situation that this panel faced in N. Ray Cohn. Okay? Yes, you have the same ultimate issue. And yes, one side may hire the same appraiser, though our side's none of us really used, I think two of us used one appraiser in common that we hired. Harry Dillashaw out of Houston, only on the inventory question, only in the convenience stores. Other than that, I've talked to my co-counsel. We're not using the same folks, and we have different issues with respect to the how we're appraising it and how we're approaching some of these matters. Commonality.
You're going to have a different approach. Valero wants to have one approach, and they want to have somebody say one time rather than 30 times perhaps or more or less that's not going to be adequate or it is, and then taking up various issues on appeal ultimately in those cases or by mandamus if appropriate. And so they just want to have that decided. Personality is the one they gave. I think they said real estate's unique, so let's take that off the table for just a second and talk about the personality. Okay. If Mr. Connolly espouses his theory and one judge says that's okay and maybe you can get a ruling on that from the appellate court and maybe you can't on the pretrial basis as to whether that pretrial judge's decision is right, what's wrong with that? That type of issue, establishing at one time when he's just talking about his theory, not resolving value.
First of all, none of that happened. There were no pretrial rulings that tossed out Mr. Connolly's appraisals. None. All that happened, and Mr. DeLosa really needs to address this because he tried those cases, so I would like to defer on that issue. But I did begin to try a case with Mr. Connolly. And we did raise some issues, and we raised, frankly, different issues than Mr. Deloso did as to his methodology, and he was allowed to testify. Same thing occurred, but we did raise different issues, and that's one of the problems with Valero's approach. You say, everything's cookie-cutter because we have one expert and we have one theory, but each of us may take a different approach to it, and facts that relate to the different properties in each of our clients' jurisdictions can be enormously different.
Now, whether every somebody is qualified as an expert, if someone is, it doesn't require the opponents to say, this is just fine, we'll take it as is. You can still shoot at it at trial. We know that. So it's just it's this gatekeeper issue that is determined by the pretrial judge. And maybe Valero's going to be right in their assertion that the method's okay, and maybe they're going to be wrong and they have to go back to the drawing board. Shouldn't the approach for personality, let's just take inventory, for instance, that they want to espouse be decided once?
No, it okay. should not. Right. It definitely should not, because there are different facts that bear on that question in every case. And, you know, when we look at it, Valero contends cookie-cutter across the board. They also treat this litigation as cookie-cutter.
There are different facts that bear on the methodology specifically in every case that makes it impossible, or I would, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but makes it not inappropriate to have one judge decide it.
Well, and as to that, it's what each of the attorneys raises with respect to those issues based upon the facts and what their experts have told them. Because when we're dealing with it, you know, you're saying, well, is he qualified? That's going to vary from case to case, depending upon the contentions of the other party and how they come to bear. You're talking about, is he qualified as, is he an expert? Does he have credentials? Well, sure he does. And we didn't, none of us challenged that. Yeah. But as to the application to specific convenience stores of his theories, and they are nothing but theories, that it has to be treated this way, it's all the same, it's all going to be sold off in Florida, off in Ohio. What facts are different with respect to that? Well, there are different facts, even if he were correct, which he was not, because that's not the way it principally sells. The facts that are different, there are different transportation costs that relate to each and every convenience store to get those items there that affect the prices they sell to the general public. And in the case that we had in Bayer, we were preparing, we had different brands. Every convenience store has a coffee maker. There were several different brands. They were all different sizes. They were different ages. They had different things that came into play. Now, those are the types of facts that support a valuation determination in these cases.
Now, have you attempted to quantify the expense that, in terms of the costs and attorney's fees and the cost of litigation that each county incurs every year in connection with defending these suits?
No, I think
so I'm wondering if it really would be more expensive for there to be an MDL process, and why would that be? Because if we're looking at individual coffee makers in every lawsuit in every county that's involved, wouldn't it be better if we just did that one time?
Well, no, it would if they were all the same, but they're not all the same, and they don't sell in the same market. And so there are, again, the fact questions are enormously different. As for the other, which is, I believe, a convenience-related issue, moving this does affect what our clients can do in attending it, and it affects our witness cost enormously. When we make decisions, frequently we make decisions and use local experts. Our expert in San Antonio was a Bernie-based appraiser of considerable background, and it was a cost savings to our client to do it. If we have to haul him to another city every time there's something comes up, when we need his assistance in taking Mr. Connolly's deposition, when he needs to be deposed, or when there are issues raised about the validity of his approach, there's additional cost for those clients. And I will tell you, the assertion by Valero that our clients don't attend pretrial hearings is absolutely false. My firm represents approximately 85 appraisal districts around the state. We have lawyers in different offices to serve those clients. And it is, our clients come to that, especially when they have a feeling that some decision there may be determinative. They want to see it so they can assess whether or not they need to proceed with this case or whether they should entertain settlement. that it makes a tremendous difference. In the convenience here is solely for Valero. All Valero seeks is further economic advantage in trying these cases. May I make a brief comment regarding tag-along? I've already exceeded the time that my colleagues had allocated me. The tag-along issue is an enormously important one here. If you allow this case, or any of these cases that Valero is claiming, to go to this type of pretrial management, then virtually every type of ad valorem case will fit it. Certainly any other convenience store case will fit it. We'll turn the tables on the mom and pop that sue our client, okay? You sue somebody in Dallas, you sue someone in Amarillo. Well, we're going to file a motion with this panel to have that moved to the pretrial court in Travis County, if it were Travis County.
Presumably you would only do that if it was cost effective for you.
Correct. Or we might...
Are you acknowledging that there are some efficiencies in an MDL?
Or? Absolutely not.
Okay.
Not for us. No. And that's I'm saying that the appraisal districts could follow what I believe is Valero's motivation, simply to make it more costly and force a settlement. With small property owners, we go to the pretrial court. It makes it more costly for small property owners, and they are forced to settle with us because economically they don't. It just more than doubles the cost of taking their case to trial on a handful of mom-and-pop convenience stores. Tag-along has that kind of implication. Look at the refinery cases. We have right now probably about 7 refinery cases, I think, going on statewide. My firm's handling 3 of them, one in El Paso, one in Moore County, and one in Big Spring. And we believe another one will be in litigation in East Texas next year. Some of the others are down in Gulf Coast. Gulf Coast refineries are entirely different than regional refineries in every factual respect. They have different markets. They produce different mixes. They have totally different costs because of what goes on. They have different profit margins. They have any number of other things that do affect the ultimate value. And so you end up with those problems. Any of those could be referred in. And Valero's contentions are not identical to the other major refiners. Valero takes a different approach as to what value should be and how it should be determined. The other refineries take a much different approach, advocating the use of the income approach, which we all know is what they buy and sell on. And so there are enormous differences in these, and I believe the tag-along implications of your decision are enormous. And they will have a tremendous effect, not only on our clients, the appraisal districts, who, after all, just spend taxpayers' money to defend their values, but also on smaller property owners that may be dragged into these things as well. And I think that the panel does need to consider the policy implication in that regard. I would like to continue speaking with you, and I have other things I'd love to say, but my colleagues need to address some of these issues and have more particularized information. So I will stop having taken too much of their time already.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. DeLosso.
Members of the panel, thank you very much, Mario DeLosso, and as has been represented to you already, I represented the Harris County Appraisal District in 4 jury trials, and the same law firm from Houston was involved on the other side. And I would reiterate quickly what Mr. Mott said, that the 06 decision got it right. Nothing has changed. Valero is, and really has, through its second request, been arguing really with the panel in the first decision, which all of those issues that we are talking about here were correctly decided in that first decision. I'll talk some more about that.
Counsel, before you go on, can you address a little bit about the differences in the expert opinions? We heard earlier this morning that those issues were handled differently by the trial courts. We also heard that the exact same issues were presented to the trial courts, and they were decided differently. Can you tell us a little bit about that since you were involved?
Certainly, and I was going to do that, Your Honor, and I will do that right now in response to your question. Thank you very much. There were 4 cases tried, as I mentioned. The first case, well, in all cases, the expert was allowed to testify. And MDL, of course, deals primarily with the pretrial issues, as you all have been expressing through your questions. All four cases testifies. In the first case, the judge allowed him to testify and did not grant a JNOV that was filed. That was Judge Davidson. In the second case involving, and let me tell you, the first case involved, my recollection, 14 stores lumped into one case. The second case, before Judge Wilson, involved 92 convenience stores, business, personal property only, furniture, fixtures and equipment. Let's talk about the fixtures and equipment and the inventory. Testified, Judge Wilson granted a JNOV on the furniture, fixtures, and equipment. The appraisal district prevailed on the inventory portion of the case. Third case, before Judge Brown in the 55th, allowed to testify, JNOV filed on the entire case, granted in favor of the appraisal district. Have I answered your question, Your Honor?
Yes. So what we're saying is that there are, that the experts were testifying regarding different facts.
Absolutely. As to the different stores, the issues that Mr. Mott went over with you, the different mix, the different location, the different brands. I can jump ahead here and read to you, if I could, a couple of lines from the first jury trial wherein the question was asked on this business personal property by me. The question was asked, they're not all the same number, are they? And the expert's name has been mentioned, so I'll say, Mr. Connolly, they're not all the same number. Answer, that is correct, sir. Question, why is that? Answer, each store has different assets and different inventory. They might have similar type assets, but I don't think there is any two stores that are identical with the same personal property and the same inventory. And that's addressing it as their expert saw it. And I agree, again, as I said a moment ago, with what Mr. Mott said. I'll be glad to go further.
That's fine.
There were no conflicting pretrial rulings. We did file, as I just mentioned, an expert challenge in each case, contesting Mr. Connolly's approach to valuation, his theory. At trial, Valero pursued its market value claim. They had the unequal appraisal claim, which, as Mr. Mott's already informed the panel or reminded the panel, you know, involves comparisons to other similar properties in the district. In the first trial, the unequal appraisal claim was taken care of by or disposed of by directed verdict. And in the remaining three trials, it was non-suited before the matter went to the jury. Now, I'm not going to talk to you much more about the fourth trial because it was it's pending an entry of judgment. Now, I want to talk to you about the three cases. The three cases that were tried in which a judgment was entered. HCAD, my client, is appealing the first case on the FF&E portion, having prevailed on the inventory portion. So we're appealing that. On the second two cases where the JNOV was granted on all or part of the case, Valero is appealing. Those are all pending in the first court of appeals. And I would submit to the court respectfully that a decision on those cases from the first court of appeals should provide more definitive guidance to all of us than a ruling from a single pretrial judge. I also believe that as Valero's costs decrease, I believe the appraisal district costs clearly are going to increase.
Let's go back to the proposition of the JNOVs or the claimed error in each of those cases, I guess. What is it about, I guess it was Mr. Connolly's testimony, what was the issue there? What was the problem? I mean, we've heard about methodology and qualifications as being the two global issues, but what is it that the pretrial judge would have to focus in on so that we can understand it? Where do you cross swords on this particular methodology,
well,
if you do?
I hear two questions, if I may, Your Honor. I'll answer the first one if I appreciate the specifics you want from me or what was the theory or what was the challenge, what was the – is that it? Is that close?
Yeah. Well, what are the issues that could be taken care of, according to the movement, on pretrial? That took place there?
Well, and that's why I said there's two questions, if you'll allow me. First of all, the expert's approach, the theory, was And this is as obviously I'm represented to the court, but I have before.
Hang on just a second. I wouldn't get too much into the specifics.
I have that concern also, Your
right,
Honor.
Because two of the judges on this panel are also judges of the first court.
Well, global, so, I mean, we're talking the universe right now. If I know what Judge Blaine is talking about. It just gives a hint, you know, as to what the, you know, in a sentence, what the contention is, so we can have some idea what we're talking about here.
It is our contention that property in Texas is appraised just like real estate, business personal property would be appraised as is where is. And I don't think I'm giving anything away, Justice Bland. These briefs are on the internet and then I'm going to keep it general. And that business personal property cannot be valued under a disassembly, removal, salvage, scrap, liquidation theory. Is that general enough? I'll stop there.
So that was the point that was decided by the trial judges.
The courts were not that specific. That's what we urged, and the courts, of course, found that there was no evidence, no competent evidence on a legal sufficiency review.
Okay. So just attack on his approach and on that kind of a basis.
Right. And the second question I heard from Your Honor, Justice Lange, was that I heard was, well, then what's wrong with, or where are we going with this? Why'd we cross swords? Why wouldn't we care if that was all done in one court? As the Supreme Court said in Robinson, rather than go on my old memory, specifically, a witness who has been admitted by the trial court as an expert appears inherently more credible to the jury than does a lay witness. We've all heard that many, many times. This bifurcates the process, the gatekeeper function that the court referred to earlier. You've got a pretrial judge somewhere else who's heard all of this, sword crossing, and then you got the trial.
But that's the whole purpose of the MDL. The whole purpose of the MDL is to decide that sort of an issue for all the cases so that it doesn't get fought 38 different or 50 or 100 or however many different times. And so your quarrel is not really with whether or not this case fits in an MDL. It's that we don't like the fact that some other judge is going to decide our Robinson motion and that's really not a basis for saying a case shouldn't be in the MDL because that's exactly what MDLs are designed to do.
My quarrel is that it does not fit MDL, and I'm going to tell the court why. But if I may begin that discussion with reading a quote from Judge Wilson in the 157th, and again, I think those words carry more import than what I could give the court. Judge Wilson said, "I'm going to deny the Daubert motion on Mr. Connolly. I will permit him to testify at this time. Although I do have some reservations, I want to hear it. I want to hear it in the context of the trial, the evidence, and the cross-examination, reserving, of course, the right and ability to make rulings on what to do with it later after I've heard it. And at this point, I'm going to allow it to come forward. I do have some skepticism, but I'm going to permit it at this time." That bifurcation does trouble me, and it troubles me specifically in the context of, and it should trouble this MDL panel in the context of these ad valorem tax appeals, ad valorem tax appraisal appeals, that these are different kinds of cases. The panel realized it before when it said these are not like the silica tire separation and the asbestos cases. These are recurring cases. The court talked about the first opinion, it was the complaint about mass appraisal. Now it's about the valuation that Justice Lange discussed in some of the first questions that were asked. And that does not link these. Those are ultimate issues. These are recurring cases. They're not linked. They're not finite. And this is my way of looking at it to answer your question, Justice Bland. They're not finite in that they don't have a plaintiff who brings a claim and brings it through litigation with an end. These are going to happen not only as the panel has observed, year after year after year after year, not to mention what I was talking about, the question you specifically asked me, what about when you have these conflicting rulings from pretrial judges? If you have more than, in response to your question, the multiple MDLs, as the panel noted in the 06 decision.
You're basically saying this will be a permanent MDL.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't use those words. I'm agreeing with you, but, I mean, the handwriting's on the wall. Mr. Tipps has already pointed out to this panel that the cases are somehow, there was some comment about their winding down. I want to tell this panel, we tried the four cases. We have no pending convenience store cases. We had one that was listed in the request for MDL, one real estate case, and it's pending settlement. And Ms. Keith will address the remaining refinery case, which her firm is handling. This is an annual event. The cases are winding down. Mr. Tipps made the observation to this court, this panel, that what we're about to crank it back up for the next season. So in response to your inquiry, I believe that's exactly what will happen. In effect, this is an MDL being asked for, with respect to my client, the Harris County Appraisal District, to handle cases that may be filed in the future. So the implications of that are enormous. The expense implications of it are enormous.
Okay. Well, let's go back, if we could, to the first part of that last discussion that was had. And that part is the determination by a pretrial judge of the Daubert Robinson issues, as opposed to doing what Judge Wilson did, which was, I have my questions, but I'm going to listen to it in context. Now, if that's what you are suggesting that we should use as our guideline, well, then would Daubert Robinson issues ever be appropriate for pretrial transfer?
Well, certainly they are, Your Honor. Look at the list of cases that have been granted and the ones that have been denied by the panel. And one can see that those are, again, cases where a plaintiff has an injury, for example, with asbestos. It goes through the process. Certain issues are resolved in MDL.
But couldn't the trial judge, the ultimate trial judge, take the same approach as Judge Wilson did in those asbestosis silicosis cases? Could say, I'm having a little problem with this, with all candor, counsel, but I'm going to listen to this in context and decide later what to do with it if I think it's not working.
Well, those are, I would acknowledge, those are benefits of MDL, but again, and we pointed this out in our brief, not in these recurring cases. When you have these recurring cases over and over again with multiple appraisal districts, 39 now but 254 potential, what this amounts to, this bifurcation of pretrial versus the judge who's going to hear it, but has to act as a gatekeeper not having heard all that. And, of course, I don't need to mention to the court, and I don't mean as a criticism of the rule, but the trial judge does have to justify her or his actions through specific findings and conclusions as to why any expert evidence is treated differently at the trial. What are the changed circumstances? This amounts to, in this context, which I think the panel clearly addressed in the first opinion, it amounts to what we've seen in the case law of giving, trot the expert out, one judge hears it, run them around the state, the imprimatur of an expert, the expert who appears inherently more credible, having cleared that hurdle. That's what's going to happen on a statewide basis. And, of course, I'm going to leave that to others to address.
That happens in asbestosis or silicosis as well. That person, whether it's the plaintiffs or the defendants, is going to be trotted around and having passed muster by the pretrial judge. And basically, that's the ruling that's going to be applied at every trial court.
I understand, Your Honor, but...
And I'm trying to get to understand, and you have to be patient with me, why it's different here as to just passing muster on somebody's qualifications or method.
No, I understand. It is different here specifically because these are administrative, they begin at an administrative level, and they go to the district court year after year after year after year. And they are purely here, and as the court panel noted in the prior decision, they're in a different circumstance than the defendants were in those cases. This is plaintiff-driven. It's going to happen year after year after year. Have I answered your question, Your Honor?
Okay, so what's to prohibit the districts the next year from saying things have changed? Judge, this if all these cases were to continue, and I'm not saying they necessarily would, before the same pretrial judge year after year getting, you know, flowing in year after year, as you suggest, what would prohibit the parties from saying, look, on behalf of the districts, things have changed. You can't use this approach this year for whatever reason. I don't know what it would be. Change circumstances. Certainly that can happen.
But as to uniformity of law, which this theory is a question of law,
yeah,
it's going to be determined as a question of law that it was no evidence, as we've represented it to the courts and is pending in the Court of Appeals. How's it going to change? The district can certainly represent that it's changed. But again, we've got the same expert who's going to be brought before the district over and over again, and in how many MDLs, in different MDLs, and that really is focusing on what I've heard here today and what I've read in the request is that if you pick a subject matter, can you argue that there's not a common fact within the subject matter? Or as Justice Hanks said, does this deal with just any fact? Can you find a subject matter where you can't say there is a common fact? And the answer is no, you can't. Can you find a circumstance? Well, I mean, we could argue both sides of that for a long time. Could I find a circumstance where we couldn't come up and say, well, something's changed? What will that mean in the context of this expert who's been pre-cleared or given this imprimatur in these recurring cases? But again, that's not the criteria for MDL. And I'm not arguing against MDL. I'm going to object so that I can look you in the eye and object, as I have in the document that was filed with you, our response, that the Harris County Appraisal District objects that these cases will be handled in this fashion in the multiple MDLs and wherever the tentacles of this thing go, that it will be inconvenient for the parties, it will be inconvenient for the witnesses, it will be inconvenient for the lawyers.
Well, he's standing up.
I think
you were aware of this.
I think I'll take that hint.
Ms. Keith.
Thank you. May it please the panel. As stated before, I represent the Jefferson County Appraisal District and the Harris County Appraisal District solely with respect to refinery and pipeline valuations. These are large, long-lived, income-producing properties and are very specific. And I would defy Mr. Tipps or Mr. Lubell to explain to the court where there is a common issue of fact. By bringing in more refinery cases, as they have this year, they have simply made commonality more diverse. There's much less commonality because all they've done is bring in more refineries. Now, let me say, as the panel probably recognizes, Jack Ratliff wrote the brief for the Jefferson County Appraisal District, and I wish that Mr. Ratliff were here to argue this, but I believe Justice Hanks picked up on one of the points that Mr. Ratliff stressed, and that is that the common issue of fact, commonality, has got to be material. Otherwise, all this increased cost, because there is no doubt but that it will increase cost, not only for individuals, overall, it will increase costs, and it will particularly increase costs for those of us who operate from the public fisc. But those costs may be justified if there is a common issue of fact that is material. Then you may justify that for efficiency's sake, for in order to prevent waste.
But usually efficiency says to me less cost. So I think the real answer is, the real question is, how do we know whether one side or the other is efficient?
I think
appraisal districts, because I think obviously by bringing the motion, Valero believes it's more efficient for it to be in an MDL.
And what about
from y'all's perspective? How do we know that the cost would be so much larger in an MDL?
Well,
if a lot of these things could be resolved one time.
Two different answers to that. In the first place, I'll have to say I don't do any of the C-store work, the convenience store works. I stop at a convenience store every now and then. But there is absolutely no way that I could avoid going to a hearing that will be strictly over discovery for convenience stores, because the only common issue is not a question of fact, but of methodology, of appraisal methodology. And with the fear that the convenience store issue on a cash register or sunflower seed package might affect the methodology that is then imposed on me and imposed on my very different experts, and that there may be some rubric of methodology that is imposed by that MDL, I cannot fail to go to one of those hearings
at some point,
and prepare.
In any case, there's going to be a methodology that's imposed upon you with respect to your opponent. Isn't that right?
No, Your Honor, I
because somebody's going to make that determination, you're free to come up with your own methodology to represent your client.
No question. No question about it. But if, as the court recalls, the gatekeeper function with respect to Daubert, Robinson challenges, those are questions of law. Those are legal questions, and they are very fact-intensive. And as you said, Justice Lange, most trial courts say, I'm going to wait and I'm going to hear it all in the context of the trial before I make that decision. In this case, knocking out an expert, approving or disapproving of a methodology, could be dispositive. And for a court in the context of a C-Store case to make what could ultimately be a question of law, dispositive issue, that's why it will add cost. That is also not a good reason, because there is a common methodology. That's not a good reason to combine all these, because that doesn't amount to a common question of fact, which would lead to reduced costs. So,
if the pretrial judge is making what could be final dispositions of these cases, is the constitutionality applicable in that analysis as well?
It is absolutely affected, and I'm going to let Mr. Brown deal with that issue. But in order to, none of us have done a study in direct answer to question, how much will these costs increase? But I can tell you how much the costs have increased solely to put together our argument for this panel, and it will be multiplied tenfold for any particular discovery-type dispute or that type of thing. So from the appraisal district standpoint, it is not convenient. And I have to take issue with this handout that was late filed with or recently filed with the court, because I think it's just not accurate. And it's not accurate for the court to believe that Mr. Mott, who says he is a Houston lawyer, and many of these blue squares are Mr. Mott. I was hired specifically because I'm a Jefferson County lawyer, a Harris County lawyer. I have offices there, and I happen to live in Blanco County, and I happen to office down the street. But there is no way that it can be convenient or more cost-effective for my people in Jefferson County to travel to Austin for pretrial. And Mr. Tipp says that doesn't happen. Well, I beg to differ with him. In my cases, because for a single county, one refinery can make a huge difference in the county budget, can make a huge difference in schools. Discovery is terrifically important to the locals. It is terrifically important to the competitors. In Jefferson County, whether or not Valero is going to get a certain type of information from the appraisal district, and there is a lot of confidential information that is provided to the appraisal district, and it is held confidential under 2227 of the tax code. If Valero's competitor provides it to us and says this is confidential, you can use it, but you cannot give it to anyone else, it must remain confidential, and that's what the statute says. But if Valero is allowed to, and they do, and we've already had two different hearings, one in Harris County, one in Jefferson County, on this particular issue, trying to get to confidential information. And let me say to the court that I think those are some of the underlying issues that you all ought to be aware of, because taxes for a C-store, values for C-stores, at least in Jefferson County, $550,000. One-third of that is their inventory. In our refinery cases, Harris County Refinery is valued at $250 million. In Jefferson County, the Valero Refinery is on the roll at $1.4 billion. And the taxes involved for our case at issue can be in the tens of millions of dollars, particularly if it goes through more than 1 year, whereas with a C-store, at least for Jefferson County, the taxes at issue are in the range of $10,000. At any rate, my point in that is They are so widely varied, the type of litigation, the type of experts, what's being used, but more importantly, the motivation for Valero to get to their competitor's information makes the tax case itself, or could make the tax case itself, pale. And so their competitors, whether it's Total, whether it's ExxonMobil at Beaumont, whether it's Motiva, their competitors are keenly interested in the discovery process, what's asked for, what's ruled upon, and what of my information are you allowed to get to. And so those competitors come or send their counsel. And so that as well cannot be a cost, you know, figured to be a cost savings when it is something that is so particularly local. Let me also say that ad valorem taxes, at least with respect to refineries, are driven by the plant manager. And plant managers, and I just settled a case with ExxonMobil in Harris County, the plant manager for the chemical facility had to be represented by a different in-house counsel than the plant manager for the refinery. They are intertwined. They've got pipes that interconnect. And they had to have two different councils because those two are competitors. They compete and their budgets compete within each other, much less with Valero or with Shell Deer Park or the others. And so I would say to the court, these are very, very uniquely different and uniquely local, local to that plant manager, local to that chemical manager. Let me say, there is, with respect to the experts, we have not designated experts in our Valero cases. I anticipate that I could very well have two different experts in my two different county cases. The issues are that different between the two refineries. The fact that there is gasoline in both. The fact that there is gasoline that comes out of the pipes in the refinery and is sold at the convenience stores brings nothing in common. There's nothing else that I can see, no pipes, no underground storage tanks, nothing else that is going to bring together a single common issue. And the fact that the question that may be ultimately asked of the jury, the fact that it is the same, I believe does not justify the additional cost, does not lead to common questions. Thank you.
I think you're getting rushed out of here. Steve? Mr. Brown?
Inspector Hook back at the office.
May it please the panel, thank you for your time today. I'm Tony Brown. As I said earlier, I'm representing Galveston Central Appraisal District. And our position is that, as well as my predecessors who have talked, that the panel got it right in its first opinion. And one of the reasons is that the construction the panel offered in its first opinion was consistent and constitutional under Article 8, Section 23 of the Texas Constitution. This constitutional provision specifies that there shall be no statewide appraisal of real property for ad valorem tax purposes. Subsection B, which is most important here, is that administrative and judicial enforcement of uniform standards and procedures for the appraisal of property for ad valorem tax purposes shall originate in the county where the tax is imposed. And I'm going to talk about the legislative history, which is set out in Mr. Mott's brief in detail. But the whole focus was to address the threat that some people perceived of a consolidated court handling judicial appeals of appraisal review board determinations. And this was a specific constitutional amendment approved by two-thirds of the legislature and voted on by the people to keep local taxes local through the trial court level. I heard counsel for Valero mention Article 8, Section 1E of the Texas Constitution. None of us raised that. We believe it's a red herring. Valero's counsel referred to it in citing the 1992 Edgewood case, which dealt with Article 1,
Article 8, Section 1E, to hold that the taxation scheme under certain circumstances would be unconstitutional for education purposes. But that's a red herring in this case. We're solely focusing on Article 8, Section 23 of the Constitution. Now, and when a court is considering two alternate interpretations or constructions of a statute or a rule, one of which is constitutional and one is not, clearly the one which would pass muster constitutionally should be adopted. Now, the specific language of Article 8, Section 23B, uniform standards and procedures as prescribed by general law, these are set out in Chapter 23 of the Tax Code, as the panel noted in its first opinion. The panel focused on Section 23.01 when holding that the cases do not involve common questions of fact and were thus not related. In fact, the panel's opinion states that the ad valorem valuation process is inherently individualized and a local process. Again, that recognizes Article 8, Section 23's requirement that local taxes be kept local through the trial court level. Now, Section 23B also talks about administration and judicial enforcement. Administration is Chapter 41. Appraiser review boards are created. They are assigned certain functions, including determining taxpayer protests, some of which involve market value and equal and uniform claims. Then the judicial enforcement, of course, comes in Chapter 42, appeals of appraiser review board decisions. The cases are replete that this is a comprehensive, specific scheme for handling ad valorem tax matters. Section 42.09A states that these are the exclusive procedures to be used in resolving ad valorem tax matters. And finally, Section 23B uses the term originate in the county where the tax is imposed. And as Representative Piotr's comments referenced in the legislative history, originate meant that it would be in the trial court level, the court of original jurisdiction, to go back to Hornbook law. Trial courts are the courts of first instance that go through the trial of a case. Original jurisdiction is conferred on the district courts, generally Article 5, Section 8 of the Constitution. Appellate jurisdiction, on the other hand, is the jurisdiction conferred on superior courts to review those decisions. So when it says originate in the court, the whole focus of keeping these taxes local wasn't simply to have a requirement they be filed in a district court and then could go to some centralized court elsewhere, either for some of the proceeding or for its entirety. It was for the trial court in the local county to handle all matters through trial. And Representative Piotr noted in his statements on the House floor, by saying originate in the county, we certainly don't mean to imply that they can't appeal to the Court of Civil Appeals at that time, and the Supreme Court in the normal course. So the plain language of this statute, as emphasized by one of the authors, Representative Pavito, clearly shows what the intent was. Now, the legislative history of the statute does nothing but emphasize that, even aside from Representative Piotr's comments that I've discussed. In the first Kirby case at 777 Southwest 2nd 391 in 1989, the first Edgewood case, in construing constitutional provisions, courts look to the history and times out of which the constitutional provision grew, the evils intended to be remedied, and the good sought to be accomplished. Prior to 1978, we had an entirely different regimen for administrative and judicial determinations of taxpayer issues. They were injunction suits in which a property owner had to plead and prove that they had grossly overvalued the property and using a fundamentally erroneous plan of taxation. And beginning in the late 70s, a reform movement grew, and the original Pavito plan was proposed in a special session of the legislature in 1978. it contained a provision for appeals from appraisal review boards to a centralized body in Travis County. And as a result of the specter of that, the legislature then proposed and adopted House Joint Resolution 1, which contained the language for Article 8, Section 23 of the Constitution. And it was passed that November by the voters. The subsequent legislature in 1979, adopted the what was known by then as the Pavito Bill, establishing the tax code, and it had the procedures we know now with the appeals to district court in the county where the property is located, and that court would decide all issues of law and of fact as set out in Section 42.23 of the code, and that those procedures would be exclusive. Now, our contention is that the motion before, or the application before the panel today, would violate that provision by creating a centralized tax court in which matters affecting a county prior to trial would be heard outside that county. As questions earlier indicated, if the court grants this MDL, there's no reason not to grant an MDL for the very same reasons for other types of property, either in one consolidated pretrial court or a variety. And we're not just talking about refineries and convenience store owners. Many retailers own stores all over the state. Many companies manage office buildings on a statewide basis in downtown locations, apartment buildings. In the greater Harris County area, which I consider Galveston to be a part of, we have certain property tax agents who sort of on a volume basis are employed by property owners. And as a result, if they have a sufficient volume, they might choose to refer those as well. So the effect is to create either one or more statewide or consolidated tax courts in violation of this statute. So this is an attempt to do an end run around the Constitution.
Let me ask a couple of questions. Your time has elapsed.
I see that.
Could you address what the movement has raised about the MDL statute begins with the words notwithstanding any other law to the contrary, which they contend, I believe, takes care of your argument that the MDL panel and pretrial transfers are expressly viewed by the legislature as something that should be allowed for the purposes stated in the MDL statute.
Well, first, the legislature certainly cannot adopt a law that violates the Constitution. Secondly, while it says notwithstanding any other law, it runs right up against Section 42.09A that says this is the exclusive.
Of course, the MDL statute doesn't originate the process. As I'm hearing you argue, the Constitution says that these matters we're talking about for ad valorem tax must originate in the district court where in the county where the property is located. And the MDL obviously is intended to transfer only pretrial matters, not the actual trial on the merits, ultimately.
Many of those pretrial matters will be either officially dispositive or, if not, certainly case determinative. So it does have an effect of deciding many cases at the MDL panel. And as I tried to explain earlier, our contention is that when they said the word originate, they meant more than file. I think certainly in light of the legislative history surrounding the Pivoteau bill, if the legislature had come out in 1979 and said, okay, we've got this constitutional provision, cases will be filed in the local county and then remanded, sent to a centralized tax body in Travis County for determinations, most of which, many if not most of which, would affect the outcome of the case, I think there would have been quite a bit of hue and cry. And so I think it's trying to put a square peg of this MDL that was designed and came up, of course, as part of House Bill 4 into a round constitutional hole. Sorry for the poor metaphor, but that's the best I could do.
Anybody else have any questions? Mr. Brown. Thank you.
There was one issue that Mr. Mott didn't have.
We're
done.
We're going to have to limit it somehow.
Okay.
Thank you. And now we have a rebuttal. And we need to put 22. Does that comport with everybody's recollection of the time? Okay. All right.
May it please the court.
Yes, sir.
I suspect that I am the only lawyer that has spoken today that has actually tried asbestos cases, silica cases, and now tax cases. And I can tell you that the similarities between the tax cases are far more common than they are in the asbestos or the silica world. We stand before you today representing a group of Texas taxpayers that merely request that this tribunal apply the rule of law the same way you did to the multitude of foreign corporations that were granted MDL status in asbestos, silica, Vioxx, Firestone, and Ford cases. Nothing more and nothing less. I want to quickly address this notion that these cases don't have a study to support the convenience or efficiency factors. And I'll tell you that the most telling evidence that we have that this would result in convenience and efficiency as required by Rule 13 is from the judge that you appointed to serve as the asbestos MDL judge and that currently holds that position. As I can tell you, as a participant in those proceedings, Judge Davidson recommended that these very cases that he tried are ripe for MDL. So when you ask, and I think it's an entirely appropriate area of concern, what information do we have that would suggest that things would be more convenient, that there would be efficiencies achieved by an MDL? Who else better to tell us than the judge that has been sitting for over 3 years governing the asbestos MDL? Now let's talk about this notion that there's somehow uniquely individualized issues in tax cases that don't apply in an asbestos or silica or other case. I'll tell you, there isn't enough time for me to give you the whole list of individualized issues in a toxic tort case, but let me hum a few bars. First of all, the jury charge. The question is individualized to that plaintiff. It's individualized to producing or proximate cause to that plaintiff. The evidence that applies to an asbestos victim of a malignancy in El Paso in a products case is almost entirely different than a case in Beaumont, Texas, involving a case against an employer for malice. They are horses of a different color. Is there some overlap? Yes. But as you stated in the Hurricane Rita case, the cases need not be congruent. And frankly, no two cases are exactly alike. The same thing applies here. What are we really dealing with here? What we're really dealing with is common sense, which nobody asked you to check at the door. And that is, when Mr. Mott, my esteemed counsel and friend, told you that he represented 85 appraisal districts, did any of you think, how could it be that it would be more efficient and convenient for him to get in his car and drive to each of the 85 appraisal districts to represent them in hearings, or to drive to each of those 85 appraisal districts to file his motion to exclude Mr. Conley on business personal property.
I thought I heard him say that he had offices around the state and local lawyers were doing a lot of that.
I assure you he does not have 85 offices. That I can tell you.
No, but if you've got five that can handle a situation, it's a lot different than him personally getting this car.
And I don't disagree with you, but there's efficiencies and convenience and cost savings to those appraisal districts if they hear the John Conley motion one time or two times or three times instead of 85 times. There is cost.
You're going to hear John Conley motions more than once, aren't you?
I don't
believe. Because if it goes to MDL, there's going to be a methodology, general, global, doctoral dissertation theory, and then there may be other attacks when he starts to apply it, right?
I guess there could be, conceivably, but if you look at what's happened in the course of the litigation, the attacks have been the same in each and every case, despite what Mr. Mott told you.
Well, now, they're contending that the facts are so intertwined and so unique, based on the local, even on inventory, for instance, based on the locale, that whatever he says generally is going to be inherently local because of what he's dealing with.
It's really not, Judge, and let me tell you why, but that brings up a great point. When you look at what the experts do on the business personal property, and that is both furniture, fixtures, and equipment, and inventory. Those are combined, and under Texas law, they're defined under business personal property. What they do is they act both sides. They go to the Internet, and they conduct searches for what are the list prices of a cash register, a microwave, a coffee pot, a hot dog warmer, et cetera, et cetera. They don't limit that search to an Internet eBay search for Brazoria County or for Lubbock. It's a farce. In fact, Valero's, most of their personal property comes out of Schurz, Texas, right outside of San Antonio. It's distributed from a warehouse there. They're not buying this stuff locally so that the value of it is determined by local issues.
Is the value determined using, for instance, income approach based on how it sells in a particular locale in the state contrasted with another?
Neither side professes to use the income approach for personal property. Neither side.
Well, let's say, assume that we grant you that there are common issues sufficient to meet the threshold that the MDL statute envisions, and that there might be some efficiencies that could be generated by treating these as an MDL. What about these two policy questions? One, the fact that even if it's not an unconstitutional thing for the MDL court to act, it certainly seems to be contrary to the public policy that's set forth in the constitutional provision that these matters of taxation should remain local. And secondly, what about the issue of the permanent MDL? And in the case of tag-along cases, a permanent, gigantic MDL?
You know, Judge, that's a fantastic set of questions for somebody that's scholarly in the Constitution like Mr. Tipps. But let me do my best to address your questions because I think they're entirely fair. First of all, permanence. As you may know, my wife, who's a sitting judge in Harris County, argued the asbestos MDL and argued against it. And I will tell you that at that time, the position of the defendants was that these cases will never stop. Year after year, they will reoccur forever. And that was a basis for granting it. Now we come in here on a tax case. Texas taxpayers are supposed to somehow be treated differently than the multitude of foreign corporations that made asbestos products.
And that's a great jury argument, Mr. Lewell, but let's focus on not drawing distinctions between defendants and things like that.
It's not any less permanent than asbestos cases that continue to be filed. But I'll tell you this. We have a body of evidence. We have a history of your MDLs. And history tells us that MDLs do not foment or increase litigation. They hadn't. just call your MDL judges and ask them if, in fact, the creation of an MDL has created more litigation. It hadn't done so. There is no evidence to suggest that.
But there's a finite number of people exposed to a drug before it's recalled or a product before it's recalled. There is not a finite number of tax years until, you know, we're blown up or whatever. I mean, that's going to happen over and over again.
And that's a great point, Your Honor. But if you look at the statistics on the number of people exposed to asbestos, it continues today. So it's not finite in the sense that you can draw a line in the sand and say, this is it. Nobody can. But your point's well taken.
Well, we know that death and taxes are the two certain things in life.
We can stipulate to that, Your Honor. Let me end on, and this is not a jury argument, Judge. Let me give you some perspective.
I miss some. Go, go.
No. Okay. Right now, as we sit here, there's 71 cases, approximately 71 cases.
Can we go back to policy before you get into this? Because you've got 12 minutes. If you're going to end up, you know, we may.
This is policy. But yes, Your Honor, okay. I'll be happy.
Well, I'm looking at Section 42.23, scope of review, which has been cited by the respondents, and it says review is by trial de novo. The district court shall try all issues of fact and law raised by the pleadings in the manner applicable to civil suits generally. It says shall try all issues of fact and law. We know that a pretrial judge can make dispositive determinations and rulings, including summary judgment. And I acknowledge that Mr. Tipps suggested that these issues should not normally be the type that would be decided on summary judgment. But I guess if I were back trying lawsuits, I'd sure try to find a way if I wanted the summary judgment in my favor. Isn't that a conflict with this statute?
I don't think it is, Judge, for a couple reasons. If we took their argument both on the Constitution and that section literally, this body of justices would not be able to have this hearing. The Supreme Court of Texas would not be able to reverse and render on a case because all decisions under their argument have to be made locally. And that's just not consistent with current legal thinking. I'll let Mr. Tipps address the specific constitutional issues and legal issues because that's frankly his area of expertise. But I would like to make one final policy point. As we sit here now, we've got 71 cases pending in 45 different district courts and approximately 30 counties. We have had three appeals that are currently ongoing. We've had two mandamuses in separate counties over similar issues involving refineries. We have an appeal that has been argued at the First Court of Appeals approximately 9 months ago for which we're waiting on an opinion regarding the plea to the jurisdiction. We have been waiting on a motion to compel for approximately 4.5 months on a refinery case that's set for trial in September, for which that court has not ruled. And now we have this. And let me give you some final perspective. Even when we agree with the district, and I'll give you a specific example, where we sit down and say this account should be resolved at $60 million, agreed settlement, what do you think happens? The Texas City Mayor, the county judge, and the school board starts to call that appraisal district and put pressure on him to change that value. And then after that timeline runs, what do you think happens? That value goes from $60 million to $193 million. And then we have to face an appraisal review board that's appointed by the appraisal district. And then you go there, and they take that $60 million to $193 million, and now they make it $240 million. This is after a contract has been entered into.
But that sounds like a policy argument for a statewide tax court rather than the reality of a tax-paying entity who chooses or which chooses to do business in county A, B, C, and D.
We're just looking, Judge.
I mean,
a
I know.
Fair judge.
Absolutely.
In a jurisdiction that's not impacted by basically an industry or a single taxpayer. That's all we're looking for.
Well, there are many citizens and perhaps some appellate judges who would like that as well. But the truth of the matter is you have a client who is a taxpayer in multiple counties and has to face the realities of life in those counties. And if there are inefficient judges, ineffective judges, then your client is certainly capable of participating in the political activities that would change the landscape.
We do, Judge, but for the same policy reasons that the statute for MDL was designed and Rule 13 was passed, we can achieve convenience and efficiency and resolve these cases justly, which is part of the second prong. And with that said, I appreciate your time. I'll turn it over to Mr. Phipps.
More time left than I thought when I was fidgeting in my seat. I was going to begin with the Constitution, but let me instead begin with your tax code question. The tax code is on a different footing from the Constitution because the MDL statute, Government Code Section 74162, begins with the words, notwithstanding any other law to the contrary. And the tax code contains a mandatory venue provision, which is to the contrary. And the provision you cited, Section 4223, if it conflicts with the MDL statute, the MDL statute would trump that provision. So I don't think that the tax code provisions can be an obstacle to the relief that we seek, for the simple reason that the legislature decided that the MDL should have precedence over the tax code provisions. With regard to the constitutional issue, first, by way of introduction, you heard a lot about legislative history. You didn't hear anything about the fact that the legislative history also includes a statement by one of the representatives that the purpose for this constitutional provision was to guarantee to taxpayers that the appeal procedure shall originate at the local level. So there's some irony here in that the argument is being made that this procedure would be unconstitutional by the taxing districts or the appraisal districts rather than by the taxpayers. But going directly to your point, Justice Stone, and the lawyers of the districts have touched on this, the provision in question says administrative and judicial enforcement of uniform standards and procedures for appraisal of property for ad valorem tax purposes as prescribed by general law shall originate in the county where the tax is imposed. If this court grants an MDL procedure, those judicial enforcement procedures will still originate in the county in which the tax is imposed. Taxpayers like Valero will still have to file suit in the counties where the taxing district, where the appraisal district is located, and that case ultimately will be tried in that district. That is where the ultimate determination will be made. I have not scoured the legislative history for this constitutional provision, though we can do more work on that if that's an issue that's troubling to the panel. But I seriously doubt that there was any discussion about MDL procedures and that kind of thing. What I think we're talking about here is something that the legislature didn't contemplate when they were passing this constitutional provision, and probably something that the public didn't contemplate when they voted for it. But I don't think that there's anything inconsistent with the basic constitutional provision that at the end of the day, these procedures should originate in the local counties and ultimately be decided in the local counties, with improving the entire way that we deal with this kind of litigation by utilizing the MDL construct.
And do you that really agree, though, that in achieving this efficiency, you cede some degree of local control? And in tax cases, you know, isn't there a policy that, especially in matters with regard to the public fist, the more local, the better. And Justice Brister just reminded us a couple months ago in the city of Galveston versus the state of Texas that the power's in the people and the more local, the better. And how does that differ then from these other kinds of lawsuits that don't involve the public treasury?
Well, I'd have to go back and read Justice Brister's opinion, and I will. But really all I can say, I would concede that if the question is how local is the current procedure as contrasted with the procedure that we recommend because we think it would be so much more efficient, and the answer would be the procedure that we recommend would be less local because the case during its middle phase, after filing and before trial, would be handled by a pretrial court. But I don't think that that is inconsistent with the constitutional principle that at the end of the day, the decision ought to be made locally. And with regard to your question, Justice Bland, about a permanent MDL proceeding, I really have two responses. And the first is the one that Mr. Lubell has already made. The asbestos litigation is probably pretty close to a permanent proceeding, though obviously Justice Stone is right. There will come a time in our country when there's no longer any asbestos litigation, but that's probably not going to come soon. But more importantly, I don't see any necessary evil in the fact that this could become a permanent procedure if what we are doing is saying that we currently have a situation in which there is great inefficiency because taxpayers like Valero, and Valero's not the only one, have to deal with these issues in all of these multiple counties, make the same argument over and over again, run the risk of conflicting rulings. Why should we not take advantage of the procedural improvement that has been provided by the legislature and consider an MDL as a way to better resolve these controversies? Well, so I don't think the fact that it could become permanent necessarily means that it shouldn't be done.
But what he just said was that it needs to be removed from the local level because you want a fair playing field and you want a judge that's removed from the political pressure that he recites in how the mayor calls and the county judge calls, and all of a sudden the appraisal value has gone back up. Isn't that what the Constitution has tried to prevent by saying we want local control and we're not going to allow you to remove it from the local process? Or did I misunderstand his statement?
Well, I think his statement was that these matters can become very politically charged, and there is pressure on local judges with regard to how they make their rulings that probably none of us would like in an ideal system.
Well, the fact that the people may not have understood what they were voting for when they passed the constitutional amendment really doesn't matter at this point because we're stuck with it. Whether you and I like it or not, aren't we?
Well, what matters is what the constitutional amendment says, and what it says is that judicial enforcement will originate at the local level. And the MDL proceeding that we are proposing does not change that. The cases would still originate, not the local level, would originate in the local county.
Sure.
And that would still be the case even with the MDL.
Judgment is granted, or unless the confines of theory that's being adopted for application on all counties changes that.
Well, what's going to happen in the pretrial court, as in any pretrial court, is that there will be procedural rulings. There will be rulings with regard to what experts can say and can't say. But we've talked a lot today about summary judgment. I haven't heard anybody indicate that there's ever been a summary judgment with regard to property valuation. I just don't think that's a realistic concern. And with regard to the issue of political pressure, to the extent that's a problem, it's going to remain a problem because the cases are going to be tried in the local courts. But I don't think it's a bad thing if by moving the cases to a pretrial court, one of the incidental side byproducts is that you get a judge who's making decisions without that political pressure. I don't think that would be something that we should run away from.
Any other questions from the panel?
Thank you very much,
Mr. Tipps. ladies and gentlemen, the case is now under submission to us. Thank you very much for your well-articulated arguments and help that you have provided to us. Now we'll have to address this extremely knotty problem that you have given to us. We're adjourned. Thank you.
All rise. The multi-district litigation panel now stands adjourned.